Come
on. Hello and welcome to Dynamite Eddie. It's the retro games podcast where a couple of owl pals get together and talk about a couple of owl games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
And Mr. Andy Mack.
Konnichiwa.
Well, fucking welcome, listener, to the Heatwave special. We are recording this, sweating our fucking balls off in the middle of a September heatwave, which is nice.
I heard that the gods have always decided that it should be sunny when the Wains are stuck in school after the summer holidays.
Aye,
just a kind of punishment to Wains.
That is good, but it is good to get like a last wee, like if you missed it, then we're going to give you one more wee week, you know. Now, whether that week's going to increase to 365 days a year in the short future.
Well, this is probably going to be the coldest September you remember in your life. They're only going to get hotter for here.
Unless the Gulf Stream gets blown off, of course.
Yeah, I've got a balcony over there, Branema, and no, it makes you sick, man, because it sits there empty for most of the year, so it's good to get a wee Branny tan, you know.
Well, do you know what I'm sitting here drinking? I've got a can of Sweetheart Stout. When was the last time you saw that gear?
I've never drank it because I always thought it was a PC on this podcast with good reason. That was a certain type of a juice that people talk about because it was low alcohol content. But I'd like to actually try it and see if it's nice.
It took me a second to realise what you were alluding to there, Andy. I think this is always a good thing today on an audio medium. Google what the can looks like, listener, because it's a total throwback. It is, to my mind, the only beer in Scotland that still has a picture of a woman on it. But she's not, like, sexy. She's not in her pants or anything like that, do you know what I mean? Just a woman's face. And I think this was marketed at woman because it's only 2% and it's very sort of sweet tasting. I remember people used to drink it mixed with Heavy. And sometimes Tennent's as well. But Andy, I was in one of your old stomping grounds, a Byright.
Right, lovely.
I saw a four-pack of it and I was
shout
like, fuck me.
Shout out to Zane.
Is this the current owner?
Ah, he's been the owner for ages. It used to be...
I remember it used to be that wee guy that would always be cheeky with you. But that was when you could get it all under one roof. You could get skins, a bottle of Bucky, and then like a fucking... kebab.
That was Robert Wright, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying. He had, what do you call that condition? When you get dry elbows and stuff and it goes off like...
Psoriasis.
So he had, afflicted with psoriasis, fortunately. And if they were short on Parmesan, then, you know, he would just get tore into pasta with his elbows.
Sorry, and you preface this by saying, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying. Alright, flaky, gaze of fucking chips and cheese with your elbows.
I'm only kidding. God bless Rob. I remember he barred me loads of times sucking up with a drink, but me getting cheeky with him, like, I'm only having a gander and that, I'm not buying it, and fuck off, you baldy bastard, and that, and he kicked us out. I quite like the guy. I see him now and again. Wonder what he's up to.
I didn't realise he was still kicking about a tune.
Ah, he's alright. I think he took no well recently. Anyway, so good with
him. Aye, it's just your Greenock News portion. Anyway, Sweetheart Stout. Weirdly sweet, as you can imagine, but not a bad can. What can's he's on before we launch in?
I'm not drinking. I was out last night, so I had a couple of vodka, so I'm happy today.
Mick?
Purely Robinson's Delighting Juice, I'm afraid.
Teetotal special. Right, now, let's get into the episode. McCormick, plug your pluggables, man, because an EP has dropped and it's fucking fantastic.
Aye, so I think I mentioned on the last episode, or possibly the one before, that I'd been gigging, been playing my techno tunes. In parallel with kind of putting my life set together, I've also produced this EP of four tracks. It's called the Revelator EP, and it is out right now on Subplant Records. It's a Glasgow record label. So you can find that on Bandcamp and fling a few bob my way. You can treat it as a kind of fake Dynamite Neddy Patreon if you want. Or you can just listen to it like normal people do on Spotify or wherever else you find your music.
And I'm not just saying this because you're one of my oldest friends, but I listened to it and it was fucking pretty brilliant, to be honest. One track in particular that jumped out at me was the spooky North Korean early morning rice tune that we spoke about on here before, I think.
It's an ambient kind of interlude called Hermetic, which is based off a creepy North Korean song.
Hermetic's a good tune.
Beautiful.
I would shout out while we're on Dynamite Neddy, the track Two Skies, which for me gets a wee bit fucking Yuzo Koshiro Streets of Rage 3, man. Yes. It's fucking cool.
I always get that vibe off you, Cosmino. Like, you can link, like, just the rhythm and the melodies, you can link that back to being influenced by Mega Drive shit, man. I love
that's kind of one of the heavier probably noisiest sort of track in it, and even more direct reference because it samples Planes Get Torment as well.
Does it? Oh, the narration. I wonder where that was fucking
from.
I was going to message you about that because in my head I thought it was Ron Perlman in Fallout. My brain was in the right sort of sector.
The thing about yourself, what's Cosmino, that's maybe different for other electronic DJs. You don't use computers or sequencers or anything. It's all acoustic. It's all the nodules and stuff like that. Your sequencers and your actual keyboard and shit. It's all acoustic.
It's all kind of modular synth stuff, which means I can kind of take it live as well and kind of mess about with it and kind of improvise live as well, which I find a bit more interesting than just DJing or just press and play on a laptop.
It's good shit. It's good shit. Right. Well done.
It's fucking magic, listeners. Get it logged. Get it on all your Spotify's and that, or as Mick said, fling him a few quid in Bandcamp. He uses that to funnel money to the Maoists, so it's all for a good cause as well. Andy, you mentioned that you've got a game to talk about during this intro bump. What are you dying to get off your chest?
Fuck me, man. So I was on my wee Game Pass stuff that day and then again, and I kept hearing about this game. It's like a Dreamcast game. It's like fucking Jet Set Radio, etc. It's called Hi-Fi Rush.
Uh-huh.
It's a rhythm game. It's got the kind of art style of Jet Set Radio where it's kind of all cel-shaded and like everything's all dynamic and the tunes are blasting and all that stuff. But the quirk of this game is, it's a platformer beat-em-up, right? But the fighting system, the battle system, is based on rhythm.
Aye.
You know that way a game can live or die in its battle system? Well, this is one that's done in a way that I've never seen before. And you find yourself actually as if you're fucking playing the drums. Like, you're getting torn into it, you can feel it in your stomach, your toes, and your elbows are going, you know, your shoulders are getting a workout. You're even singing at times.
So it's a kind of rhythm beat-em-up. Do you have the elusive, and this is an Andy Mackism, satisfying crunch?
You do, man. You do. See, when I say rhythm game, it's loose because it gives you the option to fight without rhythm. But
aye,
if you fight to the beat, there's always a beat in the music and the level kind of swells up and swells down. Not where you're doing a piss after coming down on eggies and it wasn't. The level's kind of dead, man. Like the beat of the music. Fucking so you can see it all times. Do, 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 and you're like, boom, boom. You can do a hard punch, a small punch. But the thing is, makes this game stand out as well. It's art style and the characters. The partner's quality. Characters are really interesting. They take the piss out of programmers all the time, the developers. There's these two wee robots like Ground and Scratch that turn up just like they're shite at their jobs and all that, and the world's brilliant. It's fucking,
a Game Pass special.
Aye, came out in January. It's from same guys that made Beautiful Joe.
Oh, really? So a kind of No Clover Studios in name, but those guys.
Them guys, aye. And, man, I just thinking about it now, I just want to go play it. It's just to look at it, and it's quite simple. It's quite a simple game, but it's just when you put it all together, man, because you can use a zip line, not to grab yourself onto the enemy, boom, boom, go to him, bam, 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 and then you can parry shit. No, it's great, it's amazing. I could go on about it all night, I'm not going to, but it's got to be game of the year for me so far. It's absolutely fucking brilliant.
So what sort of music is it on the soundtrack then?
I'm glad you asked. I know it's a good game and I have a fucking mark out, but remember like fucking Vince McMahon be talking and then Stone Cold Steve Austin would charge out with a fucking beer truck and you would just go on your couch and you'd like, actually move about your couch going, ah! Well, I was got to the first boss and I noticed there was licensed tracks in this game. First one's fucking Nine Inch Nails, the Downward Spiral or something.
I know.
And it started fucking rocking a bit of Trent Reznor, man. And I was like, ah, yes, yes, man. But apparently the game has this all the way through. There's tracks for like Weezer and that in it. Who's that? There's another band that was there.
The Prodigy are in it.
Fucking a Prodigy, aye, they're in it. There's all sorts in it, man. It's fucking brilliant. But there's also an unlicensed soundtrack as well that you can play if you want to stream it on Twitch, but it's great, man. It's done really well.
Class.
You're like, I know it's up your street, McCormick. It's, if you fancy something.
It's been on my radar. I'm definitely going to check it out at some point. I've got it on my Steam watch list.
It's a Dreamcast game, man. It's just a Dreamcast game that's updated graphics.
Let's get into your games for the week, eh? Unless MD's got anything else to add during this wee bit. Andy, why did you pick Little Samson for myself?
Little Samson. Well, we're doing 8-bit games a day. This is in some way an 8-bit special, I suppose. And I thought to myself, I don't know much about 8-bit games, but what I do know is that Nintendo Entertainment System was fucking huge in America. And I know that some of the games on there are sleepers, because in Britain, in the UK and Scotland, we never really had access to any of these things. We only found out about them years and years later through the internet.
Aye.
The thing that intrigues me about this game is it's a wee bit different from what you would normally get for your 8-bit platformers, and it also costs, you could probably mortgage a house for the amount you could buy this cartridge for in 2023.
We'll get into that, because I'm sure you're dying to get into a wee bargain hunt section. It's been a while. Little Samson is a 2D platformer that came out for the Nintendo / Famicom in 1992. It was published by the wonderful Taito, fucking Bubble Bobble, Space Invaders, I don't need to tell you. And it was directed by a fella called Shinichi Yoshimoto, who is actually also the brains behind a couple of Neddy favourites, like Ghouls and Ghosts and Strider. We've not had Strider on the podcast yet, but me and McCormick would be big fans of it. So, you know, after I seen that in the opening blurb on Wikipedia, you're sort of thinking, I can take this for granted that this is going to be a relatively safe bet. And you'd be fucking right. This is a cracking wee thing. For your first time switching it on, you get these kind of lovely cartoony graphics. Then you get your first shot of the gameplay. Andy, do you remember in The Sopranos where the character Hesh, he says, a hit's a hit. Adriana's managing this shite band. And he's like, no, you've got it or you don't. There's some unquantifiable thing where something's a hit or it's no.
Yes, that's right, yep.
Little Samson has got that. Spend about 5 minutes with this thing and you're like, this has got a wee something about it. Plot-wise, there is fuck all going on here, and that's exactly how a 90s platformer should be, in my opinion. You've got an evil wizard trying to take over a fantasy kingdom. Four heroes are summoned to stop the baddie. What more do you need?
Well, there was a first act twist. One of your party members turns on you briefly.
Yes, according to the instruction manual, the dragon isn't evil. The dragon just thinks, why is Samson getting to be the leader? I should be the leader.
Enough, he is a fucking dragon.
Aye. Yeah. So you do fight the dragon during the intro. I actually didn't have that in my notes. Speaking of the dragon, as well as the titular Samson, we have got three other heroes you can play as here. Mm-hmm. You've got a dragon, a golem, and a wee mouse, or I was sort of seeing him as a rat, just because I've got a bit of affection again for Brendan Rodgers after the weekend. God bless Ratball. They've all got different backstories that come out the instruction manual about how they went from being normal cunts into these kind of magical entities. But basically all of them is a wizard did it. I don't think they're particularly interesting.
They've all got kind of different movesets, which are quite cool as well. The rat one is quite good fun.
You play an introductory level for each of the four heroes, then after the fact you can switch between them. They've all got different play styles, as Mick is saying. Little Samson himself handles a wee bit like Mega Man. He's relatively fast, can shoot projectiles. He's got this kind of wall jumping. The dragon can fly for short spells of time and shoot fireballs. You hold in the fire button, the dragon changes colour and can release a more powerful blast. The golem is slow as fuck and has a shite jump, but honours a health and a powerful punch attack that can go in multiple directions. And then last but not least, wee Brendan, fastest character, best jump. And are you talking about the fact that the rat can run up walls and along the roof?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've kind of never seen that, especially on the NES. He's also got a weapon that's kind of like a timed bomb, like kind of almost like Bomberman would
do,
which is a bit tricky to get the hang of, but you can have three of them on a screen at one time, so you can kind of pepper the screen with these wee bombs and wait for them to blow up rather than like directly attacking the enemy.
That was a game changer, by the way, when, you know, you're trying out the different characters, and I was like, oh, it's got a bomb, that's not too interesting. And then I was like, hold on a minute, you can drop like fucking 20 bombs on screen at once. Yeah. Like, this is actually pretty good.
On to that as well.
One of the things that gets me about this game today, it's 8-bit, right? If you compare this to like some other games we're going to cover today, this game fucking looks like a Mega Drive game.
Do you know what stood out to me in terms of the graphics was, in particular, was the animation? Like, when you just turn it on, you see that wizard, and then he does a wee swish of his cape, and it kind of billows in the wind. I was like, that doesn't happen in an S-game.
No.
The dragon, I found myself having a lot of affection for, because some of the animations for it are just really fucking cute. It's got an idle animation. When you duck with it, it kind of puts its head down in a really cute wee way. Reminds me of Smudgy the Rabbit here, who's sitting at my feet.
It does like a 360 as well, doesn't it? Where it gets sort of rotates.
Samson's wee jump, it does a wee kind of 360.
Samson's jump.
It makes them look like they're 3D almost. Like, you don't get many games on the NES that where the sprites kind of, they've been drawn in a way that they're kind of almost get proper perspective and like almost kind of pseudo 3D. It's pretty cool.
Taito, who the developer released this in 1992, I think it was just right before the SNES came out. The SNES might have already even been out.
The SNES was already out. The Mega Drive was out. We'll get into that now. Fuck it, Andy. It's bargain hunt time. We're about to talk about Final Fantasy III. Spoiler alert. That is seen as a late NES game. The reason that didn't come out in English was because they were like, fuck it, this console's at the end of its lifespan. People in America are going to be playing the SNES. There's no point. Little Samson came out 2 years after that. So, because I think in Japan, the Famicom still had quite a lot of people playing it, and Nintendo's strategy for a while at least was that they were still making games for both systems. Aye. They thought maybe the Famicom could be like an entry-level system, could maybe get cheaper games for the older system type thing. Mm-hmm. So that's why this, I mean, it, as you are saying, it looks like fucking early Mega Drive, or maybe even mid-Mega Drive, the graphics in it are really fucking good.
I think that was quite interesting, where like you think that games look the way they do because of technical limitations of the console, but over the lifespan of a console, folk kind of start figuring out how to get the most out of it, and like they start developing more modern techniques, and the games can kind of look in ways that you wouldn't expect them to.
Aye.
What I can see for levels, it's quite clever. The colours are quite samey. Like, you're getting greens and yellow hues. They're not using much colours on the screen, but it's giving you an illusion that they are, type thing.
It's very fucking well done. But yes, this brings us on to, I mean, Andy, you're the man in the know with this stuff. How much does a cartridge go for, roughly, North American?
Let me get my suntan lotion on. What's his name, David Dickinson? Well, let's see about that then. Right. All right, so Little Samson, right? It's big business in America. This is one of the.
Yes.
Can I tell a quick story?
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay. I listen to this podcast. I'm not going to name it, right?
But if you advertise it here.
If you like it, you can plug it. I don't particularly care.
I'm not bothered, right? But the guy in it, he runs a computer game shop, a retro computer game shop, right? And he does trade-ins. And he said that the odd time people come in and try to trade them with pure expensive games. Little Samson, if you get it complete in box, is $4,000, £4,500.
Jeez,
and this is only going up. But it's been up for $2,000 in 2018, now it's at $4,000. And for a brand new copy, sealed, it's £17,000, right? There's a WATA graded one at £18,000. And if you've just got the cartridge with no manual or anything like that, you're still looking at $2,000. So, big money, man. So anyways, my story is this wee guy does trade-ins, right? And he's developed a bit of an asshole persona to keep like ball bags at his shop, right? Which seems to be a kind of constant between these type of people that run computer game shops. I don't know why, but...
It's like the, not the camp guy for GeForce that we like, but the other GeForce guy, he had that kind of persona.
Comic book guy sort of thing.
Comic book guy, aye. I think it's like a pawn shop cynicism. Anyways, right, he told a story about one time where somebody tried to trade in a sword, right, to him, and he's like, I don't take a swords. But he said, I quite like this one, so I'll do it. So he gave a guy, call it £5, right, for a sword. He said the sword sat there for ages and ages. And he said on one Saturday, a guy brought in a big box of fucking NES games. He said, right, there's about 50 games here. I'm going to have to go through them and look at them all, right? And he went through them. And sitting in there was a little Samson, right? But he said this little Samson was the most like, phony, fucking stupid-looking, like, black and white label crap he's ever seen in his life. So this guy, comic book guy, was like, what the fuck are you doing? You try to do me a fucking head? Absolutely lost his shit, man. Ripped his t-shirt off, grabbed the sword that I couldn't fucking point for a week before, and fucking smacked him over the head with a fucking sword. he spent the next 2 weeks in fucking county lockup, man. So there you go. This is the type of things that, you know, the hustle and bustle of the retro gaming market can do to people. Anywhere between $2,000 for a loose copy and £17,000 if you've got it new. But do not take it to guy unless you know it's not a repro, because you might lose your head.
This is another one that Andy's talked about before. The reason for this is, again, came out very late in the console's lifespan. Not a lot of people buying NES games at that point, so they didn't ship a lot of them over. Andy, you've said this before, where a combination of factors will drive up the price of a rare game. Sometimes it can be because they're infamously bad or they're weird, but if you've got a combination of something that's rare, really fucking quite good, and hasn't had re-releases, then this is when you're getting into your thousands.
It goes cultural relevance is number one, because you've got that Nintendo World Championship thing that's worth about like £40,000, maybe even more than that. I think it's like $80,000 for a gold one. And all that one is like the first two levels are like Mario Kart, what's it called, Link to the Past,
Tetris.
About 30 size, something like that. And it's just like it was for a big gaming competition. It was held for it. You were the ultimate Nintendo Master if you could complete it. American Games Master type of thing.
Aye.
And that cartridge is worth an absolute fortune. But you've also got the other side where if it's a truly good game made by like the most respected in the business, so you're looking at Nintendo's in-house development team. So the more obscure Mario games, the better regarded the developer and the less ubiquitous the game, the more money you get for it, or the more culturally relevant the thing was. Even today, people want to revisit their childhood and fill up their weird wee corners in their rooms when their wains are eating porridge and they're looking at their gold copy of Link to the Past, prized, complete unbox.
So, Dad, could you drive me to school? Well, I mean, I could have bought a new motor, but, you know, little Samson was $15,000. So.
That's an investment for your future, son.
Aye, but the thing is, as soon as all these collectors are dead, there goes the value. Who's going to give a fuck about a cardboard box with a little Samson in it when that whole generation's like in a nursing home?
The Beanie Babies all over again.
Exactly. False
well,
economy.
Let's get back onto the actual game here. The thing that I liked about Little Samson, the thing that set it a wee bit apart for me, after you've done your intro stages, there's a bit of strategy to this. The key to getting through your levels is sussing out what you're dealing with, what kind of level or area of a level you're dealing with, and knowing when to switch characters and which characters to be. If you're dealing with a lot of, you know, like precise platforming or whatever, aerial enemies flying about, save yourself a headache, change into the dragon. Something with a lot of vertical platforming, get your rat out. a lot of bulky enemies firing the golem. My favourite thing about this was during the boss fights, where with a wee bit of trial and error, you could sort of work out when to change character, because, you know, I wasn't amazing at this. I wasn't going to be able to just solo bosses with Samson or whatever. So you would work out, okay, this boss is a wizard, and then it turns into a giant monster. I'll switch to the golem when he changes into the monster, get a couple of powerful hits in, then switch to the dragon, etc. It makes for a good eureka moment when you finally figure out how to beat them.
I didn't really make that connection when I was playing it at the time, but it's definitely more like Mega Man than it is, say, Mario, for example.
There's shades of Mega Man in here. We are A to B platforming and switching between different tools. But whereas Mega Man is just projectiles, the different characters in this handle really quite differently. They've been get their own wee musical themes and stuff as well. Castlevania 3 had a character switching thing, but they don't handle it as radically different as the ones in this. Like, see if this was a Nintendo game for like the late 80s or the mid 80s, you could have probably based a whole game around any one of the four of these, rather than having a 4-for-1. It's really good.
My favourite boss was one of the levels actually like follows the rules of carcinisation, like, because there's a huge sprite of a crab and they can't really put anything else on the screen, so like, everything turns into a crab. It's fucking, it's massive and it's smashing, man. Big ugly motherfucker.
Shout out to the big sprites. Another feature of this that I liked is that you get these semi-permanent upgrades, which I believe you lose if you die. So, for instance, the wee mouse starts off with only 2 health. So if you find a health upgrade, you might think, oh, a better switch to the mouse so as that he can take a couple more hits. You can also find ones that make the projectiles more powerful and stuff like that. That leads to sort of risk-reward gameplay where you're switching whenever you find upgrades, but if you've got a character with a good couple upgrades on them, they become more precious. You're like, oh, do I really want to switch to them when shit's going down? Again, just very cool. Aye, there you go, Little Samson. If you are a platformer heed, this is a definite recommendation for me. Generally speaking, for most people, you know, if you gave me a shout and you said, oh, I used to like platform games, I'm looking for something to play, I would probably steer you towards your retro throwback indie games, you know, Gay Celestigo, Super Meat Boy, something like that. But I think Little Samson is good enough that you could get the ROM of it, and it stands toe-to-toe with a lot of these things. I think it's really that good. The reason it's a cult classic and not a household name is purely because, as we were saying, it came out too late in the system lifespan. But aye, check it out.
I regret kind of not playing this sooner because I literally only gave it a go like 5 minutes before we recorded it. But from that 5 minutes, I know it's a cracker.
I've not really got a bad word to say about it. There you go.
It's an extended take on Mega Man. I actually prefer it to some of the Mega Mans, I'm not going to lie. And that's controversial.
I don't think it's controversial. It's certainly less cheap than old school Mega Man.
You can get through Merit, which is, when you're talking about 8-bit games, that's the biggest compliment I think you can get, man. Once again, big fucking sprites.
Big sprites.
Johnny Branfield, CSE.
Oh, well, the Fitba special is coming up, so I hear. No, Mr. McCormick, the reason I picked Final Fantasy III for yourself, been a wee while since we've went into the world of Final Fantasy, and this is one that I always had a good bit of affection for. I remember playing it at my cousin's on a wee emulator when probably in fucking first year or primary school or something. The English translations for this go back a good while, but it was while certainly I was still interested in playing like Pokemon games on the emulator. And I thought particularly for yourself, this one, I know Final Fantasy Tactics would be a personal favourite, maybe not your number one, but up there.
Right.
And there's a sort of direct lineage from 3 to 5 to Tactics to probably now your modern online games in terms of this job system. So I just thought, if nothing else, it'd be interesting to look at from a fucking historical curiosity point of view. How did you get on?
Aye, so Final Fantasy 3, I believe, is the first mainline Final Fantasy that we're covering on this.
Seriously?
Notwithstanding that, another cursed and lost episode where we couldn't cover Final Fantasy 4 because of a catastrophic save game error.
Yes.
But we'll maybe go back to that one another day.
The best thing about that episode was that fucking couple of hours we spent on the internet on that weird kind of mod for it.
Oh yeah, the weird online bastardisation of it.
That was a different thing. That was just us fucking about on a computer during the pandemic, playing these mad bootleg Final Fantasy online games I used to play when I was a kid.
Three indies,
man. So yeah, Final Fantasy 3, this one is one of the few of these kind of mainline Final Fantasies that I never really gave a proper go of. I think the PS1 era is the one I've spent by far the most time on with Final Fantasies. But yeah, I've enjoyed kind of going back and seeing the roots of some things that I kind of came to appreciate playing the later Final Fantasies and kind of see where they came from and how they evolved over the years. So yeah, 3 was a kind of Japan-only release, as Mick was saying. It never came out in the US or in Europe, just because Final Fantasy wasn't as big a deal over here. And I think the fact that it was quite late in the console's lifespan, the fact that it was going to be a big effort to translate all the dialogue in English and stuff, I think Square just didn't bother. It's a bit of a shame because a lot of the stuff in this game kind of was very influential in kind of what we know as today's Final Fantasy. So the plot of the game is pretty standard for like a NES RPG of its time. You play as these four little kids, they fall down a hole and find this mysterious crystal that gives them a quest, tells them they have to pick up the four crystals of light because there's something bad's going to happen to the world if they don't, basically. And then an adventure sort of kicks off for there. And also, like kind of many of these games, you're kind of dragged through the plot, just kind of going from toon to toon, a toon with a dilemma. You go through a dungeon, solve the dilemma, head off to your next boss.
One of the interesting things about this, right, is Final Fantasy 2, I kind of remember your man's name, Mick. I think he was in charge of Final Fantasy 2.
Akitoshi Kawazu.
Ah, the man himself. So, Final Fantasy II took quite a departure in terms of, they were like, Final Fantasy One, you had your blank slate. At this point in time, they still thought they were making, like, Dungeons and Dragons, but for a console. You know, you make your own wee party, and then you use your imagination of how these people might interact, blah, blah, blah. Final Fantasy II was more like, you're playing through an elaborate fantasy novel. Here are these realised characters with personalities, etc. Three does not continue on from there, although Final Fantasy eventually would go on to. The characters in Three are just these four generic orphans, and the plot kind of just happens to them. Like, they're there, but they're... You know, you couldn't really say that the blue orphan is very different from the green orphan, or the two red orphans.
And it's kind of interesting, like, I've done a bit of research on the difference between, like, Western RPGs and JRPGs, and I'm not kind of fully going into it, but one thing you notice with most JRPGs up until the modern day is, like, a very different way of telling a story, where it's not like a kind of sandbox that you get in a Western RPG, and you can kind of make your own backstory in a way that, like, you're usually playing as, like, these are characters, and the plot happens to these characters, and you don't get a whole lot of say in who these characters are. But yeah, this one, they were still kind of finding their feet with that. So, plays very much like one of these early role-playing games, early Japanese role-playing games in particular. You wander about dungeons, fighting enemies, gaining experience, leveling up. You have a fighting system with four guys on the left, a load of monsters on the right, taking turns battering fuck out each other. But the main innovation of this one that would kind of go on to feature in many other Final Fantasy games in the future is what's called the job system. In Final Fantasy 1, as Mick was saying, you created a party of characters with various jobs or character classes. You could kind of mix and match if you wanted, like fighter, a thief, black, white, red mage. You could have any kind of combination of those. You could have like one of each. You could have four fighters or four monks or whatever you decided, but you were stuck with that for the rest of the game. You're kind of screwed almost, or actually you can make the game very difficult for yourself if you have quite an unbalanced party. So what this game does is it actually lets you, almost at any time, there is like a kind of currency used to do it, but basically whenever you want, you can take one of your four orphans and change them to be a different character class. So based on the circumstances you're in, you might want a party that's getting more fighters in it, you might want a party that's getting more wizards in it, and you get your first kind of selection of these jobs when you find this first crystal, and then subsequently throughout the plot you get hold of more of these crystals and they provide you with more jobs and can add more variety to what you can do in the party. This is pretty cool. A few kind of drawbacks in its kind of earlier form, one of which being that I think all the best classes are kind of front-loaded. You get all the kind of classics for the first Final Fantasy game in the first set of jobs. You've got your black mage or wizard, it's called in my translation at least, who can cast really powerful spells. You got a warrior that can batter people. Thief's pretty fast as well. White mage can heal. And a red mage is a bit of a jack of all trades, can do a wee bit of everything.
There's a bit of a lock and key thing going on with the classes here. In order to sort of nudge you towards trying different classes, the game does things like, early on, there's that game where your characters all get shrunk down with a mini status effect, which unfortunately in the translation McCormick played, the mere infamous translation, is called Midget, which is not great.
Can't be saying that.
You get shrunk down into this mini form, and basically you can't do anything unless you're a magic user. So that's the game sort of saying, hey, try out all these different magic classes. There's a boss that changes weakness, and you get a job called Scholar that can identify baddies' weaknesses. So that's kind of like, hey, make sure one of your guys is a scholar before you go into this. There's a similar bit where you get given all the dragoon equipment, and it's like, hey, maybe switch to a dragoon. So they get their extra abilities in battle. So if you're a fighter, you can maybe do attack and defend, whereas if you're a magic user, you can do attack and magic. It'll add extra commands. But they get these overworld abilities as well, which have varying degrees of mileage. Like the thief can unlock doors without having to buy keys, and then you get a dungeon where you have a lot of locked doors, so again it's kind of nudging you to be like, hey, maybe try a thief for this bit.
This is something that I quite liked actually, and this is in other Final Fantasy games when the job system appears, you don't get this so much. You're not really put in a different situations where you might want to mix and match and change things up to suit the situation that you're in. And later, when these job systems appeared, it was more along the lines of, like, you've got an idea in mind, like your kind of perfect party, and you kind of level up in certain jobs to kind of achieve what you want, to build this kind of just machine of death that's going to defeat any boss and be able to, like, fit any situation. But yeah, in this case, they tried to make it part of the gameplay, which is quite cool. And that's just one of the things I've been interested in playing this game, is like what they call on the website TV Tropes is LA installment weirdness, where if you've got like an early example of a game's franchise or a TV or comic book or whatever, and they've not kind of quite figured out the rules of it yet, then you'll get some unusual things going on. Like, for example, if you go back and read some early Batman comics and he's cutting about with a gun, shooting people. Like, in this game, you get stuff that, you know, some stuff that is carried on all the way through to later Final Fantasy games, and some stuff that they just thought, actually, this didn't work. Like, let's not do this anymore.
You've got a lot of series debuts in this. The Mogs appeared for the first time. This was the first time you got summon magic, which seems to be one of the big deals. But I suppose some of the plot elements, because although you do have your basic four crystals of the elements, you get, I don't know, there's some quite kind of trippy prog rock stuff to this. Like the woman that lives in a dream world and just sleeps all day and stuff. I really like that.
Yeah, as I was saying, like the plot just kind of takes you from one place to another. That's kind of very loose connective tissue between them. But there is some quite cool moments to it. You spend the first chunk of the game, the first quarter or half of the game at least, in this kind of overworld. And once you get access to the kind of different vehicles and you get your chocobo and stuff, you can basically make your way across the entire world map. And then you get an airship. The king of the castle where you get the airship says, oh, by the way, this is a floating continent. Once you fly off the edge of this continent, there's a whole world outside that. And that just blew me away. Like, the scope of the game just became ginormous. Like, you felt like just one of those moments where you feel like there's so much more of the world than you originally thought there was.
Aye.
It's always pretty cool. Like, Elden Ring did that a few times to great effect. Like, it's always pretty amazing when it shows up in a game. And it's, yeah, something, the kind of earliest real example I'd kind of seen of that happening. And that was pretty cool. And yeah, the plot just does have some mad, weird, funny moments as well. Like, where you're invading the place of that guy who is like King Midas, and everything he touches turns into gold, stuff like that.
This is Goldor.
Goldor, of course. So, they missed a trick knock on him, Midas. Goldor, apparently.
Goldor puts a clamp on your airship. And then you have to go to his castle and sort of be like, oh, what are you doing clamping me? Do you think it's a sex thing with Goldor? Basically, Goldor lives in a gold castle. Everything in his castle is gold. Everything you pick up in his castle is gold. All the enemies are gold. You get a fake out with a crystal where it's like, oh, here's the final crystal, the gold crystal. And it's like, well, gold's not one of the four elemental fucking earth, wind, fire, and gold, aye. And that shatters and you think, oh, no. But aye, do you think it's a fetish?
I think he's maybe just getting me money that he knows what to do with, and he's like, what's the most expensive thing in the world? That is gold. We'll just make my entire house gold. A fun kind of gameplay and thematic thing that you get in there is that if you go into a certain room of his house, he's just got loads of gold swords, and you can pick them up and you can equip them as weapons, but they're shite weapons because gold's a very soft metal. But you can just raid all these cracking gold sword collection, then sell them at the shop for a fortune, which is quite fun.
One of the questions I've got about this game is, was there a series of DS ports that they changed into 3D remakes?
Full remake, aye. And again, rather than your blank slate characters, two of the characters are orphans, and then one of the characters, like a tomboyish girl that you get in that first village where they've all turned into ghosts, Mick. And then the final one is like a royal guard or something. So they do go for maybe a traditional, or what went on to become traditional Final Fantasy thing of having these different sort of characterizations, like your wee pals, like Shy, the main character's brave, blah, blah, blah. And they go for this kind of Final Fantasy IX graphical style that they did a remake of 4 in as well.
See, that's cool as fuck, because you think about the size of these games, and they've took care to go and say, look, we need an updated one for the Wains of the day that enjoy Final Fantasy. Let's update these.
For my money, if somebody wanted to get into this game, it's probably the most user-friendly. But I find it loses something of the charm of the old... I just like the way the 8-bit graphics look. Some of these classic series staples, the tunes and stuff like that are really good.
Aye.
It just loses a wee bit of heart or something like that when it's been updated to the 3D.
It loses some of the weird kind of goofiness of the story and kind of weird disjointedness. I mentioned the airship, but like a moment that I quite enjoyed at the start is when you get hold of an airship and it takes you from one place to another. And you're like, holy shit, like, usually you don't get an airship until quite late in a Final Fantasy game. But then you get told, oh, there's a battering ram you can use to smash through a barrier. So you fly your airship into this barrier and it immediately breaks up into a million pieces. It's like, ah, fuck you, you're not getting an airship again for another 12 hours. So talking about the graphics, like, being a NES game, I quite like how it looked. It's comparing it to Little Samson also in the NES, it's nowhere near as impressive as that. The animation, everyone's get one or two frames of animation, really, but it does some kind of cool things that I never really realised that the NES could do. Some cool effects with water and stuff. There's a cool effect where you're kind of walking through tall grass, and there's a weird thing with transparency where it kind of looks like you're walking through the grass. It's kind of subtle things, but quite interesting. But my favourite thing about the graphics is just basically playing dress up with all these different jobs and seeing which job has the most swag and picking your party makeup based on that. So you've obviously got quite iconic ones that you know from the first Final Fantasy on to much later ones like 9. You've got your Black Wizard, who that's like VV basically. That's always a really cool design. You've got your Red Wizard, who's just fucking cool as fuck. He's got this mad kind of 16th century dandy sort of thing going on with a big bonnet and a feather in his bonnet and a cape and that.
The pimp hat, the Red Mage is one of the coolest looking classes.
Yeah, and there's ones in this where you don't really come up in future games, but they are quite cool as well. I like the Viking. I think he's just pretty cool looking as well. He's got a massive helmet, it's too big for him. The thief as well has got a kind of the old Robin Hood, is like Errol Flynn.
He's got an Errol Flynn thing. He's got a wee moustache as well.
Yeah, he's quite cool.
You get a final crystal, and then you get a secret final crystal. So for the last of the four normal crystals, you get basically the ultimate upgrades for your Black Mage and your White Mage. The translation I played called the Ultimate White Mage Shaman, and it had the clays for that one had a bit like your man for January 6th. It's like wearing a kind of animal skin thing.
Can your magic move any mountain?
Oh, aye, definitely.
The job system, as I say, is kind of early, sort of primitive version of what you might see in later games. It has some problems. The main one for me is that you get a set of abilities that are tied to each job. And for the first bunch of jobs you've got, the main things that you want to do in battle are covered. Attack magic, like attacking, healing, that sort of thing. And for the few jobs you get in the future, if they're not like a direct upgrade of a previous class, like a warrior will turn into a knight, which is stronger, if they do have other abilities, they're only useful in like very limited circumstances.
Yeah.
Like summons and stuff look cool, but they do like status effects and they don't always make much difference to what the party's doing. The scholar is literally useful for one fight and then you can discard it forever. But some of them are just kind of gimmicks, and it's a bit of a shame when you think, oh, I've got a whole load of new jobs to play with, and then you quickly realise that some of them are like mostly quite useless.
Yeah.
But as I said, they definitely knew that this had potential as a system, and it was something that they would take on for later games. You had it in Final Fantasy V, which kind of fixes this problem because you can sort of mix and match the abilities, so you might be able to have like some magic, but also like some support abilities, kind of swap between the two of them in the one class. Then you had tactics, which did even mirror this 10-2, where you kind of move between jobs, even in one battle, and that had kind of various benefits for doing so. And even the online game, Final Fantasy XIV, that's got this whole job system as well. And people seem to really love that. I've not spent any time with it myself, sadly.
You would think a game that gives you all these different jobs and at various points in the game says, oh, you know, switch between them, see what this one can do, don't just stay the same hang or whatever, that when you got to the final boss, which again does this fucking weird Final Fantasy thing where the guy that you think you're going to fight isn't actually the final boss, you kill him, and then this other thing comes in and says, I'm the real final boss, Cloud of Darkness. You would think by the time you get to Cloud of Darkness, that this would be the ultimate test of your job knowledge, that you would have to say, right, I reckon these four jobs are going to get me through the toughest battle in the game, and that'll be the best test of my skills. But no, in order to beat Final Fantasy III, there is a huge difficulty spike at the very end. You have to grind a lot, which is another thing, Andy, you would maybe quite like most of the game, because there actually isn't that much grinding in this one for an 8-bit RPG. You level with the enemies quite organically. At the end, you need to grind a whole lot, and you unlock these two super jobs. One of them is a powerful spellcaster and can cast every spell. The other one is called Ninja, can use every weapon in the game, and is the ultimate physical fighter. So you end up just using two ninjas and two sages.
Does this game follow the trend of some early JRPGs where it has this end section that just goes on forever, and to a point where you start thinking halfway through it, I'm too fucking underpowered for this, and now I'm fucked because I can't leave the dungeon?
Aye. And it deliberately doesn't put a save point in the middle of the dungeon, and your warp spell doesn't work in the final dungeon, which is a big tower that's really fucking hard. It's got a basement section, as I say, where you find the secret jobs. And then after you kill the fake out last boss, you then have to go and do another dungeon with four extra bosses and no save point. The game designer described that last one as a terrible dungeon. It was like, shall we put a wee save point in for them? Like, go on then. And for some reason, he says he just went, nah, fuck it, let's be brutal. Next save point.
I didn't get that quite that far. I think I'm maybe about three quarters of the way through. As I said, I just fought that boss, Griffin, where you need to be the load of Dragoons.
Aye.
Dragoon is a class I found quite funny, just for a ridiculous reason that all of the weapon animations are the same, so you're always kind of hitting somebody over the head with a hammer or an axe or a sword. That makes sense. You don't hit people over the head with spears.
No.
That looks ridiculous. You stab people with spears. I actually thought the pace of the game was pretty good. As I said, there's not a whole lot of grinding required. I did a wee bit just because I liked saving up money and buying the best of gear.
Yeah.
Everyone's really expensive, but by the time you get enough money to buy all the good stuff, you're overpowered. But it goes through at a pretty fast clip. The battles are over pretty quickly. Even the bosses, you don't find yourself spending a whole lot of time fighting the bosses, at least when I was playing it. I find that that's something with JRPGs, that there's just more and more fluff to them as time goes on. There's more and more time wasting, and like, I appreciate going back to an old game like this where you can actually get through it at a pretty decent clip. It's one of those ones as well where the main thing that you're worried about in the dungeon is like, it's like attrition, basically. Like, you've got to think about how many spells you've got, because you can't restore them like midway through the dungeon without going to sleep. So yeah, it's got that kind of old school D&D thing as well, like I only get a certain number of spell slots, so you're always thinking in the dungeons as well, like trying to be strategic as to how I can get through this with all my stuff intact.
You didn't get MP mana points until Final Fantasy IV, I think. This is the last one in the series that had spell slots.
Yeah, and that's just another kind of interesting thing of, you know, taking what came for D&D, and then over the years, kind of the Japanese interpretation of that became quite different. This still has some stuff you could probably say came for D&D that hasn't quite left Final Fantasy.
Aye.
But yeah, overall, it was quite good fun. I think there's a bit of weirdness and difference from the usual Final Fantasy that I did find quite interesting to explore. It's a bit rough around the edges. There's a bit of a trend, I think, with Final Fantasies where they have a great idea, but they maybe don't fully think it through, and they maybe don't give you, like, access to all the potential uses of it until late in the game. So yeah, it's a bit kind of funny in that way. It's some annoyances about it, but I did quite enjoy it.
There's a plot element to this that I don't get, right? Maybe you can explain this to me, right? Your main villain is a fella called Zand, right? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Zand, anyway. X-A-N-D-E. He is the student of a sage called Noah. Noah takes on three disciples, Zand, Doga, and Une. And when Noah is dying, gives Doga total fucking mastery of the material realm, aka magic. So Doga can fucking warp, can like manipulate reality at a whim.
Aye.
He gives Une control of the subconscious. She sleeps for eternity, but has total fucking control of a dream world, right? Yeah, there's a plot element where you have to wake up Une so she can help you. And then Zand, he just makes mortal, and that's why he goes mental and thinks, what the fuck, that's not a, this isn't a gift, like, what am I meant to do with this? And that sets him off on a course to be manipulated into destroying the world. What is the lesson that this sage is supposed to teach him by, is it supposed to be that he's going to save a life, Mer? I don't know, is this some kind of, like, Eastern martial arts trope or something? I don't get it.
Another kind of fantasy where there's, like, immortal beings and stuff, what you find them being is, like, a bit complacent. It's like, well, if I've got a full lifespan to do whatever I want, then, like, I don't really have to worry about, you know, the affairs of mortal man and that sort of thing. So maybe he wanted a god that kind of lived out a mortal life, so that he would sort of be a guide to other mortals.
When Highlander wins the prize, right, he becomes mortal, but also he gets the collective knowledge of the entirety of human existence, and also can have wanes because the immortals were all previously infertile. At least chuck the bald Zan, something like that. Don't just make him mortal.
They just gave him a giant cock. the other gods didn't have. It's like, here you go, have fun.
Could have went on to become Willem Dafoe.
Is this a point in the series where it moved away from its original idea and moved into the cinematic Final Fantasy that we all know and love?
No.
I think I would probably trace that more to 4.
Aye,
4's got quite an overarching story. It's got kind of themes. It's got characters with arcs, things like that. 3 was still finding its feet in terms of plot.
As I was saying, 2 is where that happened. 2 was like a fantasy novel you played out. You had all these named characters. You had a plot which, okay, it ripped off Star Wars, but they had a story to tell. It was a rebellion fighting against an evil empire, and you weren't these blank slate characters. You were very much kind of defined characters playing through the story that the people who wanted to tell. The 4th one, they didn't take a lot from 2, but what they did take for 2 was that going forward. 3 is probably your last one where your characters are these total fucking blank slate passengers who just the story happens to them rather than they're interacting with it a lot.
I'm going to need to play 2 at some point. We can get into the whole kind of lineage of that game in a later episode.
I like it. I'll maybe give you it next year on this.
A lot of folk don't like it for various reasons.
It's misunderstood.
I do like Final Fantasy VIII, which is another misunderstood weirdo intro of the series, so probably will like to.
That's a fucking weird one. See, if you're going from number 7 to number 8, you're like, what is this?
A school full of child soldiers. That's what we'll follow up our mad Japanese Blade Runner fucking cult classic way.
Stick a sword on the end of a revolver.
Aye, it was just a pure Japanese anime, that one, wasn't it? Like, to the extreme. Like a high school anime.
I've got a lot of time for 8, so I don't hear 8 slander either. Basically, I'm a basic bitch. I like them all, apart from when you get after 10. Now, that brings us on to our last game for the evening. One of the great Nintendo B-sides is a recent term we've been kind of thrown about here. McCormick, why did you pick Kid Icarus for Mr. Andy MacArthur?
I mean, pretty much that reason. It's a NES game that isn't quite talked about, but it's by the heavy hitters in Nintendo, so you know it's going to be pretty decent. This is one that I just kind of played randomly on emulation and quite enjoyed. I find it quite an interesting game in terms of the time period. It's one of these weird ones where platformers, they weren't any console games like sort of Mario Brothers, but they also weren't any arcade games either, if that makes sense. This is something kind of weirdly in between.
You would think this gameplay loop comes straight for a fucking arcade board because it's like a screen clearer in it. It's like Bubble Bobble or something almost.
Is it? So pretty much what you say is there, Mick. I mean, it's very rare that you gave me a game that was out before I was born. I'm 35 years old in next week, right? Which makes this game very old, essentially. And we were talking about Little Samson earlier on. That was slightly later on in the system, 1992. But I think this must be like just about when the video game crash in America was bouncing back a wee bit, just right after that. So this must have been an early fucking NES game, man.
So the video game crash basically wiped out the American video game market, but that's what kind of set the stage for the Japanese to come swooping in the sort of supremacy of the NES.
Aye, they made it like a toy, didn't they, rather than a computer.
I think in the same year, if you can believe it, we had the original Metroid, Zelda, the original Zelda, and Kid Icarus. Now, you could put them in any order you choose, but I think two of them are certainly well regarded now as masterpieces with long running series. And then we've got this kind of, I don't know, Ugly Duckling.
It's not really. It's what it is, it's in the vein of a lot of the games that you mentioned there. It's got similar movement to Mario. It's a vertical platformer, which is interesting. You know how the original Metroid and even Super Metroid relies heavily on like going up and down between, not only horizontal, but up and down between levels. It's got all that in it. It's instead of scrolling from side to side,
I guess it scrolls up and down, but you're always kind of going across the same width of the screen.
Exactly. We take scrolling, horizontal scrolling, for granted in 2D platformers. Remember, that was a concept at one point. I think this must have been about a time when it was just a concept that sort of horizontal and vertical scrolling went against each other and horizontal won. But if you remember games like the one when you switched the Master System on, you got Alex Kidd in Miracle World. Aye. That game was similar to this in that it used the vertical kind of concept of scrolling. It's refreshing to play a platformer with the sort of vertical scrolling instead of horizontal.
It was kind of difficult to pull off, like, technically scrolling, like the idea that you've got something that isn't on the screen. You kind of have to have a bit of the screen that you don't see, and then when you get high enough it appears. Like, that wasn't really easy to do, especially so you had to pick one direction.
Aye, so at the same time, whilst, like, because you're used to horizontal platformers or ARM anyway, the movement of the enemies are structured on a totally different kind of idea or movement and how they work within the gameplay environment. And I was saying to McCormick just when you were going to get a beer there, Clockerty, that I found it overly difficult in some places. I mean, this is a game where, like a lot of 8-bit games, where I only cleared the first two or three levels. And the reason being is, this game has sections where you've got the main world where you're going through the levels vertically, right? You start from position A and you try to get to position B by killing enemies that sort of go on prearranged paths that you've got to judge and shoot a projectile bow and arrow at them, right?
Aye.
Now, sometimes you can go off the main world and into a special room, and I remember bursting out laughing. I was like, this is ridiculous. Just thousands, no, that's kicking ass, but I'd say like tens of projectiles all going rapid or just coming straight at you, man. Like, all different paths, nowhere to go, to a point when I was like, this can't be fucking serious, man.
I started just avoiding their rooms where I could because I was like, I'm going to die in here.
See, but are some of them no shops? So it's kind of like you need to go into rooms to get upgrades, but also you're kind of fear. It's like the post box in Toe Jam and Errol. So, oh, I could get a good present here, but also this thing could go fucking ballistic and kill me in one hit.
Well, that's it. It's got RPG elements to it, which is quite interesting. Like, Alex Kidd was just a straightforward up and down vertical platformer, but this game, it gives you a bow and arrow and certain defensive qualities as well, and you can upgrade these depending on, as you said, how many points you collect. So if you go into those rooms, you've got an opportunity to collect like these wee hammer things that you can use as weapons. You can also get things like hearts to increase your health and things that attribute towards your points when you've completed the level as well. And at the end of the level, it will say power up, and it might give you like faster bow and arrows that can go at a longer distance. It's quite a short distance the arrows can go, which makes it a bit pernickety-tay. All the enemies on the screen all kind of look the same. Now, I can't sit here and bash a 37-year-old game for that.
Oh, come on now. There's the wee Grim Reaper that goes absolutely fucking tonto if you're on the same panel as him and the music changes. He's good. And the fucking wizard cunt that turns you into an aubergine.
Right.
Some of the baddies have got a bit of character in them. Come on now.
I agree with you. What I was meaning is that because I'm so spoiled in my old age and I grew up in the 16-bit era, it throws you off a bit when you see said guy, but then the alternative enemy in the level is just a miniature version of him that goes twice as fast and there's four of them.
Well, I mean, for me, Streets of Rage 2 is one of the best video games ever made, but a lot of the baddies in that are just like, oh, no, there's a green version of that guy.
Aye, like, no, do you know what I mean? I totally get you. Aye. I think the thing I was getting was I just wasn't enjoying myself. And when I played the first level and I got to the end, I was like, right, I'm here. I got to the end and fucking, I hope it gets a wee bit easier because I powered up a bit.
Aye.
And the second level, believe it or not, it was similar to the first one, same sort of ideas of baddies, and you've got these goblin things with one eyes that have got flying abilities, and then you get a Grim Reaper, as you said, that just tries to hack at you. You've got like brick ledges, and you've got icy ledges and all that, just a solid black screen, kind of like an arcade board, as you say. But the thing is, right, I think this game starts off fucking solid and might get easier as the game goes on, because that second level wasn't anywhere near as difficult, especially in the bonus rooms.
I agree with you on the too hard front for this game anyway. I'll put my horns up. I didn't play this much, 20 minutes, half an hour maybe, and it wasn't long before I was like, oh, fuck this, I'm using save states. Like, five minutes in or something like that, do you know what I mean?
I'll give you one of the examples, right? So there's four ledges in the room, slightly adjacent to each other, right? And there's snakes coming down like lemons, right? Just a constant stream of fucking lemon snakes, right?
Yellow, sour.
So they're coming down and they're landing on you, right, if you try to attack them. Oh, you can shoot side to side and you can shoot up as well in this game, right? So you've only got them options, three options. You've either got up, left or right, or down if you're jumping. And these snakes land on your head at a speed where by the time you're finished shooting one, the other snake has already landed in your head. Therefore, it's impossible to kill one without getting a hit off the other. Now, I might be missing something there, but the fact that it doesn't even give you a chance in that scenario to escape without losing a bit of health just kind of gives me that like, defeatist attitude. Like, what if I've strived to get here and I've only got one bit of health, and then the game fucks me over like that?
I think as well, when you're designing games like this, you've got to be very careful with enemies that can fly. Like, the ones that can walk about are fair enough because they're kind of limited to one bit of the screen. You can, you know, when you're here, you have to deal with these guys, whereas you always have to deal with the flying guys, and you can only track so many of them in your head at the one time, so it becomes very chaotic.
This is why we fucking hate bats so much in this podcast.
Right? Not the bat effect, eh?
Not only they poison you, but there's also you can't work out their path. That's one thing that is impressive though. Their flight paths are never the same. It's a bit like Mega Man, the bosses, where every time they move, I think they've got a choice of like eight different paths, so they can shoot down diagonal or they can go in like a sort of semi-circle motion, but the speed isn't always the same. The speeds, like there's a variance in the speed, so man, they're programmed well. And that's another thing I want to sing this game's praises a wee bit. The movement is great. You feel like you're controlling a character that's quite nimble and quite agile. There's also quirks that, depending on the terrain you're on, the gameplay changes. So, I mean, again, I'm a spoiled 16-bit gamer. This doesn't blow my mind, but at the time, running on ice and having momentum take you off the side because it's ice, I'd imagine 1986, that was quite something.
The levels kind of loop fate. Like, if you leave the screen on the right, you end up back on the left and vice versa, and you have to use that sometimes, which took a wee while for me to wrap my head around, but it's kind of cool.
That was quite interesting. It was a good way to escape an enemy, but at the same time, there was usually an enemy waiting on the other side to get you if you'd done that as well, so you had to kind of choose, like, who's the lesser of two evils here? How many bits of life have I got, and who's going to take men off me, you know? Plus, that wee Grim Reaper that you were talking about, Mick, he would sometimes just run at you, wouldn't he? Let's say, he'd look all kind of...
It goes mental. I don't know what's up with him.
Aye.
It makes a horrible noise and then fires hundreds of flying baddies at you. Just for like waking him up, I guess, or like disturbing his solitude.
But the jump, we've got to talk about the jump. The jump's brilliant. It's a wee bit like a Mario jump.
Aye.
It's good, man. It's good that you can get your ledge. There's no jank in it, so you know how I always say platformer lives or dies on its movement engine and its collision detection. Well, in this game, you're never going to have to worry about falling off a ledge because you're a pixel too much to the left.
You can change direction mid-air as well. You're not stuck in a mad fucking arc like the Castlevania jump.
Exactly. And as I said, the only way you're going to fall off a ledge isn't due to janks, because the programmers have put a bit of ice there that makes your momentum a bit more slippy. It's going to take you off the edge. It's like an intended decision rather than just like the game fucking up on you. So it's well designed, and you can tell that it's made by the same in-house developers that made games like Metroid and that and Mario, because there's care been put into how the game plays. There's nothing that happens by accident here. My only criticism is that it's too fucking hard. Do you know what? I think there might be something in this claim that it might get easier to go on, because I never got a chance to get all the power-ups. So I imagine if you power up and you get things like, I believe there's a shield that kind of wraps around you, kind of like, it's like these with super tails that attack other enemies if they can hear you. You get things that can shoot multiple bows and arrows as well.
Am I right in saying that there are sort of side-scrolling shooter levels in this? Like, two different gameplay variations? Or is that for a later Kid Icarus game?
No, I think that is like the last section of the game.
Right.
Where you actually get use of your wings.
Oh, so you climb up, you're climbing up a tower, basically, and then when you get to the top, you can fly.
Aye. The whole mythology of this is very confused. If the main thing that you should take away for the Kid Icarus story, or the Icarus story from Greek mythology, is that man can fly, and he'll be sort of taken down low for his hubris.
But
in this game, it's a weird kind of mixture of Greek and also Christian mythology, because Icarus is an angel. I don't know if it's maybe not translated properly or something.
So it's just your standard fare. The game is about a cherubim, royal guard named Pitt, and with these other cherubs, their job is to protect their queen. But they're captured by Medusa. Pitt's the only one that manages to escape Medusa's goblins, and he takes it upon himself to go on this adventure to save the queen from Medusa.
I'm sorry, after you started talking about saving the queen and all that, I can't help but now feel that Medusa is the goodie, and that Pitt and his pals are Huns. So, well done, Medusa, I guess.
I like Alex Kidd, right? And I like it because it was one of the only games I had for the Master System, and I had quirks, man. So you weren't like going up and down and being bombarded by enemies all the time. There was like motorbike sections and that shit. There was mini games and all that.
Rock, paper, scissors.
Aye, all that stuff. Whereas this is just like a barrage of intense warfare against baddies that just constantly try to fuck you over, to the point where, well, I was asking myself, am I really enjoying this? And then after being hit with things like the aforementioned scenario when you are having to take hits just to progress, I did think, fuck this, man. This obviously just isn't for me. But it's not a bad game. And the reason why it's not a bad game is because of the way it's designed. It's designed to be fucking hard. It's designed to be a challenge. Nintendo games were notoriously hard on the NES, and maybe I'm just a wee bitch.
And apparently at the time, though, this was criticised for its difficulty. So it's not just us, you know, in our kind of modern soft mindsets. Like this, there was reviews at the time that say this game's fucking too difficult.
Aye. Maybe I just need my stabilisers off, man.
I think sometimes with difficulty, just because of the, maybe some of the toxic chat around computer games, right? Where if you keep losing at a game, you keep dying, and you find it a frustrating and very good experience. If you are a good person in the eyes of gamers, you're going to say, well, this is my fault. The game isn't wrong, I'm wrong. There's that whole kind of get good mentality.
Aye.
Sometimes a game just isn't well designed enough for you to want to push through that difficulty barrier. There's a level of enjoyment that Kid Icarus Disney have that maybe Mega Man does.
Oh, that's it.
That you want to keep playing Flame Man's level and get the satisfaction of slapping him, whereas for some reason you feel stifled trying to beat Kid Icarus. I don't know.
What I think is, I think on reflection, right, and using reflection as a kind of key tool here, is because I grew up in the 16-bit era, there's probably a lot of aspects that I take for granted in games, right, that this game is probably a trendsetter in. As again, a lot of things were probably just concepts at times that I'm taking for granted.
Aye.
So it's probably many a me problem that I found this game so difficult and kind of hard to negotiate. But I know it's not a game, it's me, because it's well programmed, it's well done, it's well designed.
I think it's a game.
Well, it could be. I'm just offering an alternative argument, because I mean, I have been in that situation before. It might just be that I have a problem with 8-bit games at times.
If somebody told me that they couldn't beat Mickey and Donald and that they tried their hardest and that, you know, it was just too hard for them, I would say, that's your fault. You're a baby. you don't know how to play computer games. Kid Icarus, it's too hard. It's a different thing.
The thing is, man, like games like Contra, right? I love games like Contra. Contra's really difficult, to a point where once you're over the age of like 13 years old, your reflexes no longer allow you to play Contra.
Contra has the... We've touched on this before, you know, Meat Boy, where you die a lot and it flings you right back in.
Right, yeah.
Contra, mm-hmm. for an 8-bit game, between losing a life and restarting the level, it's a couple of seconds. You really get flung back in.
Aye.
And it's got that, oh, one more try. You know, like an arcade
That's
game.
A good point.
Oh, fuck, have I got another 20p I want to rattle into this? I don't get that for Kidicarus.
That's a great point.
Sometimes when I die in this, I'm like, I don't want to play this anymore. I'm quite happy to put this down and no play anymore tonight.
Like, I totally agree with that. I totally agree. And the difficulty for like shoot 'em ups and games like Contra, and games like, God, I was going to pick up your Afield one, Gynog, but games like Radiant Silver Gun and, what's that one with all your base that belong to us? Zero Wing.
Zero Wing.
And all that stuff. I mean, you're going to die. But as you said, as long as you get six lives, you're just going to keep going from where you left off, and so you know how to get in the next bit because you died at that bit and stuff. But as you're saying, you just go back to the start of the level or even get a game over in this game.
I'm glad we can kind of have a nuanced discussion about difficulty in games, because I've kind of forgotten that was possible. I've been on a few internet groups in the past few days, and I'm not going to name names of certain Facebook groups, but just the fucking most worst and toxic discussions about games. If somebody brings up the word From Software or Dark Souls, everyone just loses their collective minds, starts fucking shouting at each other, throwing things on either side.
I'll not click into them. See if I own one of these left book gaming groups and it's another fucking thread about FromSoft being ableist, right? Maybe it is. I don't fucking know. I'm no reading 500 comments back and forth about it, right? I don't care.
There's no new insights to be gleaned for this here.
No.
I think that's it. I've got to use Reflection here because the game is well designed. It is what it is. It was made in 1986. It's not much to look at. I think that's a big problem for me too. And again, that's a me problem. My games has got to be a bit of a spectacle to look at.
Regular size sprites, just not going
to
cut it.
I've got to have something. I've got to have something to fill that gap of, I've not got this imagination, I dare say, that you guys might have with RPGs and stuff where you can bridge the gaps. I've got to have it kind of presented to me in a kinetic way on screen.
Going back to what I was talking about at the start of the episode, the start of Little Samson, Hesh for the Sopranos, right? A hit's a hit. I don't think Kidicarus is a hit necessarily. You look at Zelda and Metroid, now that's a hit.
Aye, could be that as well. I mean, if you plant five seeds, right, if three grow and one kind of half grows, that's a success, isn't it? So maybe this is the one that wasn't successful. The run to the litter.
You might have learned a few new cultivation techniques that help you become a better farmer when you're growing your next batch of seeds, as maybe Kidicarus gave to the world of Nintendo games.
But aye, again, it's one of those situations where I'm not going to sit and slander something, but I know it's not crap.
It would be unfair to call it crap now, but I just think I don't know how much fun the average person is going to get out of this. I would quite happily, as I say, sit down with a straight face and say, play Little Samson. It's a platformer for 1992, but I genuinely think you'll enjoy it. You'll get something out of it. For most people, you kind of say that about Kidicarus.
This is on the older side as well, the games that we've had on the internet.
Yeah.
Aye. So we have to take that into account as well. I mean, we're a good age.
Okay.
Fucking, this thing was before we were born, man. Aye, so I take that into account as well. Ugh, it's not for me, perhaps. I mean, you know when a game's for me, because I'll sit here and I'll talk 90 mile an hour as if I've just fucking...
Well, you've not made any sound effects. That's usually a giveaway that you've enjoyed something.
Aye, that's my opinion. That's all I can offer. Just...
Well, do you know what? That's fair fucks at the end of the day. We're not going to love them all. And you gave it a fair shake. You didn't slaughter it. And I think that's quite fair.
Aye. That's the thing. If we kidded on, we liked everything, it wouldn't have been much of a show with it.
No. But again, you don't want to get into that fucking... It's all right when the angry video game nerd does it, it's his shtick. But he ruined an entire generation internet video game discussion because you've got to be angry.
Critical.
You've got to say, oh, this is shite. Oh, I can't believe it. And
aye.
What is this bullshit? The Grim Reaper goes mental. The Grim Reaper's...
some folk just don't... It's not in their nature to be evaluative and critical, but... If I don't like something, then I'm going to explore whether it's me and reflect whether it's me first before I slaughter somebody's work, you know what I mean?
Aye. No. That brings us on to the end of our episode. Andy, I know you like them. Why don't you tell us what we're in store for next time?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're having the football special, Mac Free, man. Great guest this friend of the show, Johnny Branshield, is coming back again.
Yep.
And we're going to be, now, am I right in thinking here that we are going to be attending the Inverclyde Derby?
Well, Mac, you don't know if you can make this.
I can't make it, sadly.
Can't make it.
You can maybe phone me.
Aye, we'll record. Maybe you can give us a voice note with a prediction on it at the start or something like that. But aye, we are going to go to Greenock Juniors versus Port Glasgow Juniors and record your intro there, I believe. Aye.
So we've got all to look forward to. We're going to be watching Greenock Juniors versus Port Juniors. Greenock got relegated to third division in the West of Scotland Football League, and they're playing each other, and it's going to roll back years, you know. Obviously, Port Glasgow being a very, very bitter and angry enclave against is going to be wanting their blood, Mick. I don't know where I'm going to be eating the pies because I might be putting cyanide in it.
A bitter and angry enclave, it just so happens to be where all of my grandparents came from, so thanks for that.
Well, you might be on the other side then, yeah. C-U-N-T. But the full thing will be happening. You'll be getting a pie review. You'll be getting all sorts. You'll be getting the intros back. I just sang it earlier now.
As I understand it, Greenock and the Port have both started the season pretty fucking poorly. So I would maybe like to see, you know, a high-scoring, slide-tackling, kind of comically shit. Maybe a rainy Friday night at Ravenscraig, I don't know.
Aye, I'm quite looking forward to this vibe because, I mean, in Inverclyde 2023, we don't really see much of a division between the Greenock and the Port. Sort of the same thing now, innit? But back in the day, man, it fucking wasn't. And I want to see them days return for 90 minutes, man. I want balls to the wall, slaughter.
They've built all those housing estates in between the two and the big Tesco and stuff like that, so it's kind of healed the divide.
Aye, aye. Plus, Greenock's got a real football team. But that's not a bad day, bye. But, aye, we're going to do that. We're going to make some fucking noise. And then we're going to review some football games again for yous.
Yes, we're scaling back somewhat. We're not doing two games each, just because, we can be honest now, the football special is an annual fixture. And plain and simple, we don't want to run out of games, so we're going to be slightly more precious with them. You're going to get four games, one features. I'm going to cover Striker for the Mega Drive. Old school fucking Mince and Totties FIPA game. There you go.
I'm going to be pretending to be somebody that understands the nuances of football. I'm going to be putting my anorak on. I'm going to be playing Championship Manager 01-02. A real FIPA game, none of your kiddie on FIPA games that I've kind of managed to squeak by with last time.
Right. I'll be at a football game with spreadsheets, so you still feel a wee bit in your comfort zone.
Still in my wheelhouse.
And I'm going to be taping over Tiger Tim on side B in my cassettes as I put Roy the Rovers on a cassette tape and play it on a Commodore 64. Some long-lost Gremlins graphics software limited game about your favourite comic book fucking striker. It looks like Stuart McCall with the mullet and all that.
Johnny is going to be covering the Hurricanes, which you might remember from fucking Saturday morning cartoons kind of vibes in the 90s. I'm not sure if that's on the Mega Drive or the SNES. I think it's a weird platformer where they use their special Hurricanes powers and kick flaming fitbuzz at people and things like that. So that'll be good crack.
Is that right?
Well,
is that one with Jockstein in it? Well, it was a version of Jockstein.
Andy, I don't think Jockstein was in the Hurricanes, mate. I don't know what you mean.
No, I think that's something else.
Jockstein died in the 80s, right? And I don't think he was the type of man that would have sat down and recorded a cartoon even if he was alive.
No, was that what I'm saying? Was he gaffer, like, based on Jockstein?
Did they have
coach?
Did they have a Scottish manager?
I used to be raging all the time, remember? He was just a father figure. He always wore like a bonnet and he'd have a big tash, remember?
Well, do you know what? I don't know,
Alex
but
Ferguson into it.
I'm more apt. But I'm looking forward to finding out, I tell you that. Maybe I'll watch a couple of episodes before we get into it. But aye, yous have got that to look forward to for your second September episode, if you like. I suppose all that's left to say for me is up the workers and God bless Mama Robotnik.
Got to go faster, faster, cheesy, cheesy pasta.
Yeah, I know, I've got to believe.
See yous later.